Good evening, this is Gary Kavanagh here on the right side. I'm here today with my friend and colleague, Michael Dwyer. Michael, how are you?
I'm okay, Gary. Thank you.
For one brief moment this weekend, I thought it was finally going to be over, and we could never have to talk about Brexit again. Unfortunately, Boris Johnson's deal to get Britain out of the EU has not gone exactly how was expected. That's the big news of this weekend. We're actually going to hold off until Monday to talk about this, for the very simple reason that Boris Johnson is after sending letters to the EU, and a great amount of stuff is probably going to happen over today. So rather than putting something out, which by the time you hear it might be out of date, we're just going to wait until Monday, and then we'll talk about this in kind of detail there.
We will, and just in case listener is getting too hopeful, even under the best of circumstances, I think we are right to quote Winston Churchill after the victory at Alamein. This is not the end. This is not even the beginning of the end. But this may be the end of the beginning.
That's a terrifying thought, Michael.
Oh, this could go on for 20 years, Gary.
It could. I can't imagine the amount of frustration the average British person must be feeling with Parliament by now. Like, the average person who cares about politics on either side.
And I suspect that on this particular issue, you're talking about more people caring than you would on most issues. Now, if you imagine how bored even people like us who are kind of saddened, engaged, get about a lot of politics. The only politics in Britain for the last 2 years has been this.
Sky News launched a Brexit free channel.
God.
Took them 2 years to see that business opportunity. And I saw people reacting to it by sort of going, well, this is absolutely terrible. This is important news. To which I think the sane response is, yes, but sometimes you just want to not hear about it constantly.
But also, Gary, just to be picky and pedantic about it, which you know is not in my nature, the word is news. N-E-W-S. Things that are new. And I would postulate, Gary, that in the last 2 years, things that have been new fall into the category of damn near fuck all.
This has really taken all the oxygen out of the room. So instead of Brexit, what we're actually going to talk about is a couple of things that are all linked together.
Yes.
So the first of them is the Holocaust Museum has taken Irish welfare to account because someone put up a sign above the main door of a welfare office that said Jobpath macht frei.
Well, Jobpath, actually in German?
Of course, go ahead, Michael.
In German?
In German,
not,
yeah.
Jobpath makes you free.
Sorry, I thought you were going to correct my pronunciation there.
No, in German.
No, Jobpath macht frei.
I misread the story. I had assumed that makes it even, well, I was going to say better, worse, whatever, that they were translating. And they said, job path makes you free. Actually, it was job path macht frei. And they even did it in not quite the font/calligraphy of Auschwitz, but in a similar style.
Yeah, so for those who aren't aware, Auschwitz, the German extermination camp, and work camp, depending on exactly when you went there. It was lovely in the spring.
There also two before camps, the extermination. The small camp and the big camp. But the big camp really was the big extermination camp.
Above the main train entrance to Auschwitz, there was a sign that said Arbeit macht frei, which I'm probably butchering the pronunciation of, but is German for work will set you free, or work sets you free. So someone put up a sign over a welfare office in Cork that said job path sets you free. Obviously an allusion to the Nazis. They did it in roughly the same font. It's a sticker and it even curves in the same way the sign above Auschwitz curves. And Gardaí in Cork are now appealing for witnesses because this is now considered a potential incitement to hatred case.
The other odd thing about it was initially, maybe this is no longer the case, but initially the suggestion it seemed to be that they believed that this had been done within the Department of Social Welfare.
Yeah, people seem to legitimately think that a low-level civil servant in the Department of Welfare went, God, you know what we really need to improve our reputation with the public? clear links to an extermination camp.
And they put this up as a Maria slogan for their offices. And people seem to take this notion slightly seriously, that an Irish civil servant would think that what is obviously grossly offensive and inappropriate and horrible at many, many levels, but an Irish civil servant would think that that was somehow was a reasonable and appropriate thing to do. You and I have met over the years many, many Irish civil servants. Now, some of them have their issues. I would generally say that when you're dealing with them one-to-one, they tend to be nice, helpful people. But even in Cork, I can't imagine that there's somebody. Why would anybody believe that this was anything but the act of some kind of saboteur?
But even the fact that the Gardaí are now considering a potential incitement to hatred incident. I mean, incitement to hatred against who?
Yeah.
It's very clearly a piss take of job path and internships.
Yes, it is. It's obviously something.
It's not even a terribly good one, but it made news, so I suppose it did its job.
It did its job. Does it fall within the theory, or was it trying to fall within the ambit of what we might call satire? I don't know.
I mean, the fact that the Auschwitz Museum on Twitter reached out to the Irish Welfare Department, or to welfare.ie, and asked them to remove it, and gave a very earnest explanation of why this was wrong.
Yeah, kind of. Well, there are probably... No, in fact, that's not true. There are places in the world, and there are probably many places in the world, where you do have to explain why this is wrong. Remember, Gary, the cases, there were a number of restaurants in India, at least two chicken joints that I can remember, that had, one of them was called Hitler's Place.
Yeah, I think the difference there is that there's actually a long history of India, and particularly certain segments of India. Not only, it's not that they're unaware of Hitler, it's that they think he had sort of the right idea.
I think that, to be fair to the Indians involved, I think they have a very, very tenuous and flawed grasp of what Hitler was at. They see the swastika. The swastika is a very ancient Vedic and symbol, and it's commonly used both by Muslims, Jains and Buddhists in India. And these would have been used on the signs and stuff, and then Hitler thrown into it. And I think one of them actually, the staff had uniforms, either say brown shirt uniforms or SS uniforms or something. And it had to be explained to them that this, because I don't believe that there is an indigenous tradition of anti-Semitism in India. There were what they call Cochin Jews down in the south of India. There have been Jewish communities there a long time. But anyway, my point simply is that there are places in the world where it might be reasonable for the Holocaust Museum to have to try and explain, but actually, you know, this was what happened and this is why this is a bad thing. It's rather unfortunate that they thought Cork was one of those places.
Mm. Asia is also one of those places that is kind of gets the Nazis, doesn't really get the... It's weird, they just don't have the revulsion towards the Nazis that a lot of the Western world has.
As I say, I don't know the details. I suspect if this is the case, they may not be furnished with the full details of what they were actually up to.
Japan could be very well informed of what they were up to, and a sort of, well, you know, that's what you have to do.
I would hope that that's not true, but maybe.
Oh, come on. You remember how the Japanese treated the Chinese?
Oh, absolutely.
And pretty much everyone they could get their hands on.
I mean, there's a long and rich tradition in Asia of
committing atrocities.
Well, Japan, of China, the Mongols, hordes coming down, sweeping across. I mean, when they came into northern India, do you remember one of the cities they came to, they created a pyramid. Over 200,000 skulls.
That's just effective communication.
They destroyed ancient cities in Persia that had been there for literally thousands of years and then just disappeared off the map, never to be seen again. So, yeah, I don't doubt that, but Anyway, now, as you said, the kind of interesting thing from where we are and how we're going forward in this country is the involvement of the Gardaí, because it's incitement to hatred. Now, you asked the question, well, how does this work out? Incitement to hate whom? On what basis? And of course, we have the example of the commissioner at the moment who said he has worked out or is working out a workable framework for the definition of a hate crime. Now, there's a couple of things that strike one about that off the bat. First thing is, it's not really the job of the police to create legislation.
Not traditionally, no.
You know, and I would be feeling far more comfortable if this kind of thing was done by Timmy Dooley sitting, paying attention in the Dáil and voting.
Or not sitting, paying attention in the Dáil and having someone else vote for him.
Well, you know, sometimes a person...
As long as the votes are cast.
Sometimes a person's busy. I don't like the idea of policemen getting involved in the process of writing legislation. That's not their job. And they should be reminded of that vigorously. Let's ask the question, because I have a feeling that it's coming down the tracks at fairly high speed towards us. What is a hate crime?
Well, I mean, let's take in this instance. Who, incitement to hatred, presumably needs to incite hatred towards someone. You can't have this abstract hatred. And, I mean, what do we think was happening here? That we're putting job path Macht Frei above welfare office, and if you went in for the Dáil, civil servants were going to turn you into soap?
Well, I would imagine that if anybody is being portrayed in this context as being hateful, that what they're saying is job path is hateful, because they're drawing the analogy between job path and the Nazis. And they're saying job path and Nazis are equivalents, and that kind of equivalence would suggest that it's an incitement to hate job path. Now, that's a tricky one. Incitement to hate a branch of the civil service, rather than, and then presumably you personalise it by individuals working within that. They are the object of the hate in this case. But, okay, here's the question. It's incitement to hate. It is not incitement to violence. It's not incitement to riot. It's not incitement to assault or to murder, right? It's incitement to hate. Hate is an emotion. We're going to make a crime out of feeling something. Inciting people to feel something will be a crime. Do we think that that is in itself a good idea? Leaving aside whether or not feeling that thing towards those people is a good thing or a bad thing, I would say it's, on the face of it, a bad thing. But is it a good idea to make feeling a crime, feeling something, or inciting people to feel something, a crime?
Well, apparently the Garda Commissioner would like it to be so.
We've talked about this at least tangentially before, and I find it very worrying and distressing in the sense that there seems to be a tremendous lack of real reflection about what this means. We have made significant, really significant advances in the way we look at criminality and crime and what is worthy of punishment and prosecution, what isn't, over the last 300 years. We've abandoned the idea of inherited guilt. We've abandoned the idea, or we had abandoned the idea that you could be prosecuted for thinking something or believing something or holding something to be true when other people did not, or even feeling something. These were all things that you could have been prosecuted or indeed persecuted for thousands of years in human society. It was perfectly normal to do that. But we stopped doing that. And we applauded. And we said the Spanish Inquisition was a bad idea and all similar things like the Spanish Inquisition, by the way, gets a very bad rep. And
of course, everyone did in fact expect the Spanish Inquisition, because they wrote ahead by mail.
They did. And they took...
they gave you written notice that they were coming.
And they took ages to get there because the roads in Spain were few and far between.
It's actually, if you ever get the chance, it's worth reading some of the translated notes from people involved in the Inquisition. Because it's mostly people going, basically, these bloody peasants, this is just an elderly woman, why the hell am I here?
Absolutely. For years and years and years, there was a whole mythology built up, going back to what was called the black myth or the black legend, which came out of 16th, 17th century England and 17th century English Protestantism and Dutch Protestantism and the pamphleteers, where they were trying to, for political as well as religious reasons, Spain was, you know, this dark and terrible place. And there were huge archives, which had been basically untouched. And one of the reasons they'd been untouched was because they were so big, because the Inquisition kept absolutely meticulous notes on everything. So the massive, massive archive. But you know when your sources are not so few, but rather so many, that it's intimidating. So people looked at, oh, God. But around 20 to 30 years ago, they started to get into the records in Barcelona and in Rome, or in Madrid. And exactly what you said came out. These terribly banal, rather boring, rather dull, dry legalistic documents, where again and again they were saying, no, this didn't happen, and that's just silly. And, oh, God, why didn't I stay in Seville?
It's one of those weird things when people are talking about the witch trials and things like that, and they make the point that shouldn't it have been obvious to these people that these people were not communing with the devil because they were so incredibly easy to capture. And then when you read some of these notes, that line of thinking is explicitly there of, this is nonsense. Why else would they have been so easy to capture?
There's one case where the prisoner is being kept in a room, and there's a big keyhole on the door. And one of the things that apparently this poor lady had been accused of was that she could, I think it was this case where she used to turn herself into something like a warble fly or a horse fly or something and torture the animals of her neighbours, you know. Just be a bad neighbour. That's a classic thing, you know, putting a hex on the animals of your neighbours so they would stop producing milk or the cows would be born dead. And the Inquisitor's response was, if she can turn herself into a fly, why hasn't she turned herself into a fly and flown out through the hole in the door and escaped? Why is she still in there? It actually became the case in the end that the Inquisition actually introduced a rule, which meant basically a law in Spain, that you couldn't accuse. Now, there may have been limits to this, but you basically couldn't accuse somebody of being a witch. Because every again and again and again, people would make these accusations, and they would turn out to be harmless old women who somebody had a set against, or somebody wanted their land, or somebody had decided they wanted to vindicate an old family vengeance and then the Spanish was no, enough already with this. And in fact, if you look at the number of women hanged, because principally witches were hanged, not burnt, in the great witch trials, I don't think there were any in Spain. The great mass, now the numbers are also exact, historically were much exaggerated by some historic accounts written in the 70s, feminist accounts, but still, large numbers of women were killed, were executed for this. But it was in Germany and in Scandinavia, principally. Some also in France and in England. We only have one incident where somebody in Ireland was executed for witchcraft.
Yep, and so because they kind of, the witch thing just didn't pan out, but was mostly just peasants complaining to them, they eventually went back to their traditional job of finding Jews.
Well,
crypto-Jews.
Crypto-Jews, yes. And even then, not that this makes it a better thing, it was all about business. It was all about money. And principally the king saying, I want that guy, that guy, that guy, that family, that family. There's a lot of stuff there. Let's see if we can confiscate some of their gear. A bit like Henry in the monasteries.
Come for the daily news updates. Stay for the principal defence of the Spanish Inquisition.
They were all lawyers as well.
They were, yeah.
The Inquisition, where it was actually a moment of change, where it, what the Inquisition does try you for believing certain things. And that was one of the reasons why it was considered to be hateful by Enlightenment thinkers, like people like Locke and like the Enlightenment thinkers in France and in the United States, who regarded this as an example of an absolute recrescence of the Dark Ages, that you could be taken before a court and prosecuted for believing something which was heterodox. Modernity is this thing. People can believe and feel in ways, as long as you don't do actual harm. That was the modern principle. You could be prosecuted or taken under the law by the civil authorities if you did somebody actual harm. And it seems that one of the things that's going on here is, in the last number of years, we have expanded the notion of harm hugely.
So hate crime legislation is coming down the line, almost certainly. So just a very quick kind of idea of why this is a terrible idea, just on a practical level. It's because traditionally you don't get to control. There is this weird thing where people will come out and say, like, hate crime legislation, they'll use it to stop us from saying everything. In practicality, that's generally not how it works in Europe. No, the problem with it has always been that once you accept the principle that the state has the right to determine what words you can and cannot say, you have no control over who actually gets to decide those things.
Yeah, and what happens is these quasi-judicial bodies get set up and they appropriate legal authority. Very often they don't, what legal authority they have, very, very dubious and very fuzzy. But they'll set up a commission or a council, and that will be and you'll have to go there for mediation and things like that. But they will have power. They'll have power for sanction, they'll have power maybe to call witnesses and take evidence. But they will be operating outside of the normal judicial system. So they won't be like the Inquisition or something. They won't be judges. They won't be trained judges. They won't necessarily be lawyers. Now, we've seen this kind of justice in operation in the elite colleges in the United States, have we not, over the last few years?
We have, and now we've seen the resulting court cases and class action lawsuits coming down the line to them because of it.
And that's not the way you want to run a railroad. Like, it's great that at the end of the day, we can say, well, you know what? Ultimately, we will be protected because we have a constitution which protects speech and freedom and all these things. And that's great.
Well, no, we have a constitution that protects for each subject to limitations.
Yeah.
And quite large limitations, if you want them to be. Like, the limitation of public order can mean pretty much anything you want it to mean.
I would agree in theory, but the fact is that the interpretation of the constitution is in Ireland is also considerably hemmed in by precedent. And precedent in Ireland on issues like this has tended to be historically stronger on individual liberty than it has been on the principle of public order. If nothing else, because public order is something which is very hard to define.
And yet we will undoubtedly try.
Oh, well, they will.
It reminds me of, I hope it goes this way. The British anti-obscenity laws. The laws that banned pornography and things like that. Not the current attempt, the previous attempt they had. The first thing, and what would have then been considered radical lesbian groups and feminist groups pushed for these laws because they believed pornography degraded women.
Yes.
The first business that was closed under it was a lesbian bookstore.
Yeah.
There's sort of things where you can't stop something that's terrible coming down the line. So the only real thing you can get in it is a pleasure when it goes against the people who brought it in an absolutely predictable fashion.
The obscenity law in Britain contained, the central idea was that it was seen if it was likely to deprave. So the explicit lesbian material was considered by the courts as obviously something likely to deprave young people. Famously in the court case about whether or not Lady Chatterley's lover was obscene material or not, the prosecuting barrister asked the men of the jury, was it the kind of book that they would want their wives or their servants to read? Obviously not. And therefore they should find it to be...
I think that's just a good principle of law, generally. Is this the sort of thing you'd be comfortable with your wives or servants doing?
Now, will this be associated, or is this associated, with hate enhancements?
Performance enhancers for hate?
No, what I mean is, for example, in the United States and in England, if you say I'm walking down the street and I get attacked because, God love them, they think I have money and they steal my wallet. That's just an ordinary assault and theft. But if I can demonstrate that they were assaulting me because they thought I was gay, or because I was in some sense perhaps handicapped, or because I was a member of an ethnic minority, there would be that element of the crime, that hate element, would amplify the crime and leave it open to a stiffer penalty or a higher tariff penalty.
How exactly does a stiffer penalty go with hate enhancements?
Simply, if you can demonstrate that the crime was a hate crime.
I know. I'm just trying to get you into a position where I can turn this into a sexual pun.
Okay.
And it's not going as well as I thought it would. So I'm just trying to prompt. my real problem with these kind of laws is actually not the speech element of it.
Yeah.
Which is saying something, because generally I'm quite strong on free speech. Stronger than I should be, because I really enjoy seeing some of these people hoisted by their own petard. It's the fact that when people talk about equality, and there's this thing currently where people will say, equality of outcome is not what we want. Equality of opportunity is what we want. That's total nonsense. You can't have equality of opportunity. For the very simple reason that people will come from different lifestyles, they will come from different socioeconomic classes, and no one will have the same set of opportunities. It's just a feel-good measure for libertarians who want something to, but don't want to, you know, they want to oppose equality of outcome. The only actual equality you can have in a state, and you can have really in the world, is equality before the law, the courts, and the state.
Mm-hmm.
As the only kind of equality that can actually exist in any human structure and not be nonsense. This assigns a value to different citizens based upon their characteristics.
Yes.
And I find in that way it is deeply offensive to democratic principles.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would say, when I've written about this before, I use the language that it's deeply offensive to the very notion of the Republic. Anyway.
Shall we close it on that?
I think we might close it on that. And we'll be back on Monday with a Brexit edition, which I'm sure that will mean nobody will be here to listen to us.
All the best.
Bye-bye.